This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. All eyes were on the governor last week as the legislature chose which man would get that position, and then Governor Peter Shumlin, newly anointed, delivered his inaugural address. There was no question about who was going to be the lieutenant governor. Phil Scott, the only Republican elected to statewide office, is now in his third term. In his inaugural address, Scott said he hoped the senators gathered in front of him would, quote, view every bill through the lens of, will this help our economy? Will this improve efficiencies and reduce costs? And to that end, he had already started trying to get feedback from Vermonters on their ideas to steer the economy in the right direction. On the first night of the session, Scott and a bipartisan group of legislators called Vision to Action Vermont held an economy pitch event, and Scott explained the problem.
As I've traveled the state, the consistent theme I've heard is that we have a crisis of affordability that we're facing. People are struggling to make ends meet. And we've had a number of businesses that have left our state over the last couple of years. And as businesses leave, so do the jobs and opportunities for Vermonters who want to stay and work here.
Then the 70 gathered lawmakers heard five-minute pitches from Vermont business people. We're going to hear some of what they told him today, and we'll find out what else Phil Scott has on his agenda for the session. Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Well, thank you for having me on, Jane.
It seems like Vermont jobs and the economy has been your focus for all three sessions so far that you've had as lieutenant governor. In fact, in your inaugural address, you said that you're basically just repeating yourself because we haven't accomplished the goals that you want to see accomplished. So what specifically do you want to see?
Well, I think that we have some challenges ahead, and we have a population that's stagnant, 625,000 people. We have a demographic that's shifting. We're losing the category from 25 to 45. We've lost 30,000 people out of that category alone over the last 10 years. And I think that we have to shift our focus. That's the working class. Those are the folks that are paying the bills, they're paying taxes and so forth, growing families and living in Vermont. So we have to focus on opportunities, and we have to make sure that there's opportunities so that we can keep our way of life, our good quality of life intact, and also expand the economy so more people prosper, and so that we don't have people working two and three jobs trying to make ends meet and putting fuel in their oil tanks and so forth. So I think, you know, again, my focus is try and lift and boost the economy so that more people prosper.
But that's what everybody says. That's what the governor says. That's what House Speaker Shap Smith said in his opening remarks. It's, as you've mentioned, what you've been saying. So why aren't those things being accomplished in your eyes? Are they too hard? I mean, Vermont has struggled with those things since it came into existence. Or are lawmakers not doing the right things?
Well, I don't think we're focusing on that issue as much as we should. In the last biennium, 2 years ago, we had 1,211 bills that were introduced into the legislature. Out of those, we looked at the bills introduced. Out of the 1,211, about 20 of those would have had a positive effect on the economy. And in reality, only two or three of those passed. So I would contend that we're not prioritizing the economy, that we're taking up an awful lot of other issues that that are important, maybe important to some. But I would argue that the economy should come first so that it can help everyone. And I think that Vermonters, those who voted, would agree that we have a bit of an affordability crisis in Vermont, but a better economy would fix that.
We're talking with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, and listeners, if you have thoughts for him, if you want to share your ideas on what would improve the Vermont economy, he's telling us he's all ears, so you can call 1-800-639-2211. Or if you have a question for him about statehouse security, about education funding reform, about this idea of economic progress and what he thinks should be done, again, our number, 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So, Lieutenant Governor Scott, do you have specific ideas of what you would like to see the legislature do? I mean, beyond saying focus on the economy, what direction would you push them in?
Well, again, I think the speaker is adopting the right tact here. He's addressing the property tax issues. I think that that will be a major event in the House. I think that there are, again, of those bills that were introduced in the last biennium, I think that there's still some things that we could do there. The R&D tax credits that we disbanded with over 2 years ago, I think those we should take a look at those. The cloud tax is something that we're taxing now. I think those are incentives that businesses look for that might want to land here in Vermont. I think those are areas that we could look at.
The cloud tax, meaning you think that's a good thing so that companies like Amazon, online retailers that are taxed, is that what you're talking about?
The cloud tax is where we decided. And businesses that ask us, if there was one thing that we should not do, we should not tax the cloud. But we move forward and put in a provision where we will tax the cloud. And I looked at, you know, we have a captive insurance market that works very well from Vermont, and very few people understand it. I would contend that very few legislators actually know what it does. But every time that there's a change, when they ask us for a change to better the industry, to help grow that sector in Vermont, we do it. And businesses have asked us for a number of things. One of them saying, don't tax the cloud. This may be insignificant at this time, but this could attract new businesses, the dealer.coms, the My Web Grocers. They're the ones that asked us, the Green Mountain Coffee Roasters at the time asked us not to tax the cloud. But we did it anyhow. And I think we have to revisit that. I think we have to have a better relationship with our businesses here in Vermont so that we can look for a brighter future and look for new opportunities. And again, that's why we decided to bring the Vermont economy pitch on the first day of the session that we visioned action. Heidi Sherman and Paul Ralston, together with myself, had that Vermont economy pitch on the very first day. So that we could start off on the right foot.
So you'd like us to revisit the tax, the cloud tax that Vermont does have. That's one specific that you'd like to see in order to help businesses do better and to satisfy some of the requests that they have. How do you make sure that what's good for business is also good for Vermonters? Maybe not in that specific case, but you know, we hear a lot about the need to grow in businesses. But should there also be some thought put into whether the jobs that are being developed offer good benefits and good salaries and good training to the employees who need to take those jobs?
Absolutely. And that's what the legislature's for, to debate those issues, to take testimony, to actually take a look inside some of those particular items. And I just mentioned those two. Mm-hmm. It's just things off the top of my head. But we heard from a number of folks at the Vermont Economy Pitch where they were talking about developing innovative solutions to confront some of those issues, reforming processes, looking for some talked about the Act 250 process. And I know that that's something that we've talked about for quite some time and we have an aversion to. But I think that we need to look at some ways that we can, have more access to capital where we can. Somebody talked about methane digesters as a way to combat pollution in Lake Champlain. So there were a number of different initiatives that came out as a result of that we are going to distribute all the summaries to legislators so they can take another look at, maybe take some testimony on those items, and maybe there's more in the future. I hope this is just the first step in trying to take a look at what we can do to help, to work together. And I'm not saying giving a blank check to businesses in Vermont. I'm just saying let's listen to what their needs are so that we can all grow together.
Yes, and again, this economy pitch was the first night of the new session. Lawmakers gathered and they heard these 5-minute pitches from Vermont business people on what they think could improve the economy and what they'd be looking for from the legislature. You mentioned, Phil Scott, you're going to gather all of those suggestions, all of those pitches together, and you're going to give them to the entire legislature. I understand there were about 70 lawmakers gathered there that night.
That's right. And yeah, we're going to distribute to all legislators so that they can, those that didn't attend, some couldn't because of other commitments. But we also have the video that ORCA had done that we're putting on, showing them where they can watch it if they'd like. And again, that summary of the items that each individual pitch came up with, some of their ideas are going to be there in writing. And again, there may be others that this will maybe spark an interest in. And I'm sure that there's many things we can do to help ourselves.
There wasn't a ton of consensus, though, from these business people. How do you prioritize which suggestions and which initiatives are better than others?
Well, again, I think that that's a challenge. Obviously, I think that once we've dissected what each individual pitch was trying to tell us, and then maybe we can see some common themes, and then from there, legislators can take a look at what easy things. I talked with a number of legislators that came out of there, and I'm talking about both Democrats, Republicans, and progressives that came out of that and saying on a few occasions, well, that would be easy to do. We ought to give that a try.
Like what?
There was just something that they had mentioned. I don't remember exactly what it was, but they were saying there was one. In particular, maybe it was Dan Smith that was talking, and from the Vermont State Colleges, and said, or VTC, and they said, well, geez, that makes a lot of sense. Maybe we ought to try that. So I know that there are some legislators that are contemplating legislation at this point, and we'll see over the next couple of weeks what they come up with, what comes out in terms of in bill form, and what we can do in the committees of jurisdiction to help.
Again, we're talking with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott right now, and we're talking about the Vermont economy and what might help grow jobs, grow good jobs in the state, and make Vermonters feel more financially secure and secure in where they live. If you have a suggestion, you can post it at vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition, or you can call 1-800-639-2211. We're also going to be talking about possibilities for refining our education funding model and what might happen in terms of school board consolidation and other issues that the lieutenant governor is looking at. Let's go to Hank, who's calling in from Morrisville. Hi, Hank. Go ahead.
Hi, yes. Thanks for taking my call. I am a small business owner. I own a bike shop here in Morrisville, and I do sell on the internet, and I do believe that the internet needs to be taxed because big people like Amazon and stuff are just getting away paying nothing, and it makes it harder because they keep selling for less than I sell. And then I drop my price, and then they keep going lower, and it's like there's no fair game with it, because it would actually raise their percent. If you say you raise it to 6% mandatory tax on the internet, it would actually force them to raise their price about 10%, because they would have to now collect that money and then pay that each month or whatever, like I do.
Yeah,
Hank, and let me just jump in here and say, you know, we were talking about the cloud computing tax, and that is separate from the internet sales tax, which is what Hank is talking about here, and companies that sell on the internet, you buy it and it's shipped to you. But go ahead, Lieutenant Governor, you can respond to him.
Yeah, thank you very much, Hank and Jane, for clearing that up, because that is not what I was talking about. I firmly believe, as Hank does, that we need to do something about the internet tax, the sales tax. I believe in buying local. I think those that have made the investment. I've been a small business owner for over 30 years now, and I understand the struggles of having a physical plant here and investing in Vermont and actually, you know, putting your dollars where your mouth is means a lot. And it's not easy doing business. I don't care, you know, what state you're in. So I understand the struggles with the internet and what that provides, and particularly with Amazon and how easy it is for people to shop there rather than go to the downtowns. But, you know, we enjoy this social fabric, this community in Vermont, where we rely on those small business owners to help us. And I would I've tried 4 years ago. We went on a campaign, you know, buy local. It's not just for hippies anymore. And just tongue in cheek talking about that, but trying to promote the idea that we should be investing in these small businesses, giving back because they've given us so much. So I agree with you, Hank.
Let's go to Tiki in Burlington. Hi, Tiki. Your thoughts?
Hi there. Good afternoon. Thank you. Just curious, Lieutenant Governor, of all the voices out there to choose to give a, I'm sorry, of all the groups out there to choose to give a voice to, why did you select businesses versus those who maybe don't have a voice, like low-income folks or those struggling to make it day-to-day?
Well, again, this was just the first step that into a process that we hope will expand. And we're trying to give an opportunity for those folks that are in the business community, those that are in business, that would like to expand their businesses. They'd like to do something to grow. And we'd like to give them that opportunity so that we can help all sectors, so we can help people have opportunities to have a job and find that independence so they don't have to rely on everyone else. They can help themselves. So we thought it was just a good first step in trying to give them a voice and have everyone collectively hear what some of those ideas, that maybe there's something simple we can do that would really, really help all of us. And again, it's not that those voices that you mentioned should be discounted, but they'll have opportunities as well. And again, if we can grow the economy, if we can bring more revenue into the state naturally, without, you don't have to raise taxes, but you can, if you grow the economy, you can actually bring more revenue in by your existing resources. So that's what I'm contending. And it just seems the obvious step to take as we move forward to try making a better Vermont.
So is the philosophy here that if you help business owners and business leaders grow their businesses, they will employ more Vermonters, and those who perhaps are at a lower income level or who rely more on government services will be helped by that? Is that the philosophy you're working off of?
Well,
here?
I think that's part of it. Obviously, I think that the more we can do in terms of helping some of those businesses expand, bring more people on, expand their employee base, as well as expand from a physical standpoint, the ripple effect of that is incredible, because you have contractors going back to work, electricians, mechanical folks, you name it. To have the corner grocery store would benefit from more employees, and it just grows from there, and that ripple effect will help all sectors, I believe.
We're talking with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. Let's go right now to Elliot, who's calling in from Manchester. Hi, Elliot. You're on.
Thank you for taking my call. Lieutenant Governor, I think you're hitting the nail squarely on the head in believing that if Vermont really does its job to help businesses to come into Vermont, and businesses that are here to thrive, all boats will rise. And I certainly believe that. You hit on one issue, which was Act 250, and in watching a project trying to get off the ground in our own town of Manchester, have seen how failed this process has become in Vermont. A local business person came forward with the idea to open a hotel and a spa about 5 years ago, bought a property on the edge of the village that was commercially zoned, went through the local planning process, the local design review board, and then the full complete Act 250 process has taken 5 years to get through that. They were finally issued their permit last summer, and right away, two of the people during the entire process of a resident in town raised a grievance, and now have delayed that project by another year. And that is stopping business from coming into Vermont and stopping businesses who are here from growing.
So, Elliot, people, you'd like to see some changes with Act 250?
You need to find a way to streamline Act 250, and the state should step forward and say, no, and it's not going to take any longer than a year for any business to get through this process. We're going to streamline it.
Okay, so what about that? Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, streamline Act 250, tell businesses no longer than a year you will be able to build if you're approved.
Well, I think that it's not just Act 250 that I think is a barrier at times. It's the whole permitting process in itself. And that has to do with the local permits. It has to do with state permits. Act 250. federal permits as well. And we have to, we've talked about this for quite some time. When I was first in the Senate, I was on the Natural Resources Committee. We had an Act 250 bill that had some good things in it. I think the House had one as well. I worked with Peter Welch and Ginny Lyons. We were the three that were going into negotiations with the House, and that took a year and a half. And I think that it's time to take another look at how that helped or hurt, whether we could do more, and how we can integrate all the permitting processes together so that we don't duplicate and we don't just run the clock out for some. And there has to be, I know that there was one person that was talking the other night about how easy it is to stop a project and for no better reason than just to stop the project. Now, we don't want to hurt our environmental integrity. We have a quality of life that is part of our selling point. It may be expensive to live in Vermont, but a lot of people appreciate what we are, and and that's part of our environment. So we have to be careful. It's a balance in terms of we don't want to overdevelop, but we have to develop enough so that we can all live here and stay here and call this our home without moving to other states and then coming back here to retire. And that's we have to live and grow here.
Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, we've been talking about economic priorities for the session that just got underway and what he's hoping to see the legislature accomplish. Coming up, we're going to talk a little bit about education reform, health care, state house security, which the Lieutenant Governor will be working on this session, and other issues that are important to you. If you have a question for him or a comment, our number is 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition, and today we're joined by Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. He's sharing his philosophy and some ideas about where he'd like to see lawmakers go in this legislative session that just got underway. If you have a comment for him or a question about what he's thinking about the economy, about health care, about security, other issues, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That number again, 1-800-639-2211, or post your comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Ryan in Plainsfield. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'd just like to say I think the prosperity and wealth of Vermont and Vermonters here lies in us all having our basic human rights fulfilled, like health care. And I'd say that I'd like to just hear you talk about how universal health care might actually reduce the burden on towns and reduce property taxes by meeting a big cost of insuring all the educators. Thank you.
Ryan, thanks for your call. Lieutenant Governor Scott, you put out a press release after the governor said he wasn't moving forward on universal health care, saying that was the right thing given the financial picture he presented. Ryan saying he still would like to see it move forward and it could be beneficial for towns. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think what his statement was that we weren't moving forward on single payer at this point. I don't know if that's what everyone's, I guess, definition of universal health care is different. And single payer has many different different levels and connotations, and it's how the way you look at it. I, as you know, have been a skeptic of the single payer process. I'm a believer in universal access, but single payer has been one that I've wondered about for a number of years since it was first spoken about and passed, what it really meant, what it was that it, what did the policy look like, how we were going to pay for it, who was going to pay for it, how much. And finally, we received the answer to that. And I would contend that over the last year or so, that our inability to move forward on this issue one way or the other has had a detrimental effect on the economy. I think that there are a number of businesses that have not expanded, have not expanded their employee base, have not expanded their physical plants because they have no idea what was going to happen in the future. There was just that uncertainty about what that was going to mean to their business. So I'm very pleased that the governor has at least given us a definite, I guess, his opinion on what we should do, and so that we can move forward at this point. Now, what do we do at this point is the big question, because we have a healthcare problem. It's something that we have to continue to work forward on. My belief is that we have the Affordable Care Act that was enacted by the federal government. It's something that we'd have to adhere to. We have an IT system that's dysfunctional even today after putting almost $100 million into that needs to be functional. We need to be able to allow Vermonters to have access and to change their policies and pay and know that they have insurance when they do so. I was speaking to one of my employees yesterday who we were forced out of the health insurance business because we were under 50 employees. So we had our employees go on to the exchange individually. And this one employee has decided to change from MVP to Blue Cross Blue Shield over a month ago, had to do so over the phone, but still has not received her card. Has received her check back from payment. But when she called to ask whether she could, she's going on a trip, what she should do because she didn't have a current healthcare card, they said for her to use the old one, which is an MVP. So my contention is we need to put this on the front burner. We need to get the exchange working properly. And that should be really priority one. And then the healthcare committees are going to continue to work with the Green Mountain Care Board on trying to reduce costs and making this system as equitable as possible.
Let's go to Steve, who's calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much. I just want to say that the election, I think, for governor was really not so much about the healthcare reform. I think governors, the people of Vermont spoke clearly, it's the economy. I think most Vermonters are pretty cool with the changes we're making in healthcare, and we're proud of it as a Vermonter. I'm a Democrat, for example, but I can't agree with the Lieutenant Governor anymore. I think that I was one of the 500 that went to the Precise workshop, and we had over 500 Vermonters for 15 possible jobs. It's obvious that we need to support small business to get the economy better. I think the Governor, Lieutenant Governor, is absolutely right. I just want to say that. I think that's what Vermonters were saying, and that's why I think Governor Shumlin heard us. I think he really heard loud and clear that we've got to do something different to get the economy going for all Vermonters.
Steve, thanks for the call. Appreciate that. Let's go to Joe in Marshfield. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
It's me. Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much. This is Joe here in Marshfield. I want to tell you, Phil, we think you're doing a wonderful job. I love it because you race cars. You're really a good guy, And I would have voted for you if you were running for governor, so I wish you would do that. But my question is, what are you planning on doing about the marijuana thing? You know, is trying to make some revenue off this stuff. Would you think it'd be a good idea to get some money coming in instead of being like Shelman? Let's wait to what Colorado's going to do. And wait, come on, let's be vanguards on this. Thanks, Phil.
There's Joe. All right, Joe. Thank you for the call. Joe wants to know, quote, what are you going to do about this marijuana thing? Phil,
yeah.
Scott?
Thanks, Joe. I appreciate it. And I hate to burst your bubble here, but I'm on the Shumlin bandwagon here in terms of waiting to see what happens with Colorado and Washington. And let me explain why I'm thinking that. It's because I'm very concerned about impaired driving. I think that we've come a long ways with alcohol, impaired driving, and so forth, and we're able to test to be sure that you can drive safe in terms of alcohol content. But we don't have a system that is usable in terms of impairment with marijuana. And I think we need to watch. We don't have to be the first in the nation on everything. And I think I'd like to see what happens in Washington and Colorado and see some of, maybe the good and the bad, and then move on from there. Whatever happens at that point, I think we can go in with our eyes wide open. So I probably should have quit while I was ahead, but I thank you for the call anyhow.
During the campaign, you talked a lot about the need to reform our education funding model and education model in general, and you brought up a plan that would engage a committee kind of like the Green Mountain Care Board. The Green Mountain Care Board is in the healthcare realm. It approves hospital budgets. It looks at ways to make healthcare spending more affordable across the state, hospital budgeting and spending on things like that. You want to see something similar to address education spending. Do lawmakers need to address tax policy changes first, or do you want to see that board put in place to do the work of deciding the best way to raise funds?
Well, again, here's what I think about education reform and property tax reform in general. I know that there are many that are talking about changing the formula and how we tax Vermonters for education. And I'm okay with making changes to the formula. I'm okay with doing it a different way if that's what we choose to do. But at the same time, we're going to have to address the spending side. We have to do it concurrently. It can't be done. The spending is what the problem is. If we do it any other way, it's just going to put pressure on another sector. It's going to come out of another pocket. And I don't think that's the answer. So what we have right now, we're spending $1.5 billion on education in Vermont. We're spending, $13,500 per student here. And when you look at it, and we were talking about it the other day, when you look at spending $1.5 billion to educate 80,000 kids, I believe, 10,000, we have 10,000 teachers. If we had that money and we're starting out today and we had to devise a plan to educate kids and we had $1.5 billion to spend, I don't think we do it the way we're doing it right now. So I think we have to think outside the box a bit. I believe in local control. I'm willing to give that latitude. But what I said during the campaign was, if we're not willing to take that political risk, if we're not willing to do that work, because it's difficult politically to change the way we do things, then maybe we need a different model. Maybe we need an education board of sort, like a Green Mountain Education Board that would make those decisions. But legislators can make those decisions, and I'm willing to allow that process to happen. Again, I know the Speaker has talked about it, and the House is taking the lead on this, and I look forward to what they come up with. The Secretary of Education has talked about the challenges quite a bit, and she's on the right track. I think she'll be supportive and helpful, and again, we need to work together on this, because in the end, we're all Vermonters and we're all paying the taxes and we're all feeling the burden. So let's try and think about this outside the box. And if we have to go to a different model, then maybe we need to have the political will to do that.
Well, and we'll be talking about that tomorrow. Secretary of Education Rebecca Holcomb will be our guest. So we'll put some of those ideas to her, and including the idea of a statewide teacher's contract, including the idea of ed funding and other things that might work to help deal with education spending. But while we have you on the program today, Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, I want to talk just briefly about State House security. On Thursday, starting before the inauguration of the governor and carrying on into the evening, there was a protest by people who were angry that Governor Shumlin has stopped moving forward with a plan to finance single-payer health care. In the end, protesters refused to leave the State House when it was due to close, so 29 of them were arrested. It was noted that during the inaugural ceremony, senators had to, you know, kind of sort of push and shove and elbow their way into the House chamber, and the governor had to do the same, although he did have a security detail with him. And more police, including state police, were at the State House for the day of the inauguration. The protest was known to be happening. You're leading a security working group that includes several lawmakers. Do you think there needs to be more security at the State House?
Well, we are talking about that. We did have a study done by Margolis Healy over the summer, and we're going to be talking about possible changes to security in the State House over the session. The institutions committees are going to take the lead on that. The State House security, in terms of the governor's address and so forth, we knew something was coming. We had our eyes wide open. We weren't quite sure what the extent of it and what was going to happen. But again, I think all in all, democracy is messy at times. There was a certain point in time when I thought they went too far in the disrespect they showed to Reverend Potter. But he was the right person for the job at that point in time, and I thought he rose to the occasion, and I thought he was just what we needed.
After the inaugural address, yeah, when the protesters were vocal, and he brought them sort of into the fold in his remarks.
Right, in the way he did it. I looked over at Reverend Potter. I've spoken to him many times before. I have a great amount of respect for him and like him personally. And he was going to be coming up to speak, and I was presiding, and I looked over at him and gave him told him to come over to see me. And he came up, and again, he rose to the occasion, and I thought he was just what we needed.
But specifically looking at possibilities, my understanding is that the State House has been wired for security cameras, but they haven't been purchased. They haven't been authorized to be installed. Do you think that would be a good idea?
Well, we'll see. I mean, I'm willing to allow the institutions committees the latitude to look at that. We had them wired because we were doing an upgrade to the fire alarm, and it just made an incredible amount of sense to just bring in from a cost standpoint to bring in that extra wire while we were doing that, just in case we decided to do that in the future. So,
why not pop them in then?
Because we're not ready. I think we have to have that discussion. We have to have that debate. We have to have people testify and make sure that I want to keep the State House as open as possible. And I want to make sure that it is the people's house and that we can have those messy discussions. I think it's important and healthy. But we have to show respect and civility for each other, too. And we have to be able to listen, because that's the skill we need. We all need to listen to each other a little bit more.
It certainly would change the atmosphere if, for example, metal detectors were installed at the entrances to the State House. Vermont is one of the few state houses and legislative bodies where you don't have to go through a metal detector to get in. Do you think that would change things?
Well, I'm sure that's going to be one of the areas of discussion. But, you know, I've been one of those that have been hanging on. I like the openness of the State House. I very much appreciate seeing the school kids run across the in the morning on the way just to get warm as they're walking to school. So I'm okay with the way it is. But at the same time, we live in a different time, different world, and we have to be realistic and we have to be pragmatic.
Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much, Jane.
Coming up, why Vermont is at risk for major cases of embezzlement. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. For the third time in 6 years, an annual report named Vermont the state most at risk for major embezzlement cases. Perpetrators face strict penalties, a maximum prison sentence of 10 years, and fines up to $10,000 for each count of theft, according to state law. But that doesn't seem to be much of a deterrent. Chris Marquet is the CEO of Marquet International, an investigative security consulting firm that published the report. He joins me now. Chris, welcome back to the program.
Welcome, Jane. Thank you for having me.
What makes Vermont such a good or not good, but strong candidate for embezzlement?
Well, you have to step back a minute to understand how we came to the numbers in the first place. What we did was, first of all, we conducted a study. We've done it now for 6 years in a row. And it's basically a white paper that it looks at embezzlement, employee theft across the United States. And it looks at major cases, meaning cases where more than $100,000 was stolen from the organization. And the organizations could be anything from a nonprofit or religious organization to a government entity to a privately held business, a publicly traded company, and anywhere in between. So we look at those, and what we do is we look at the characteristics of the schemes themselves and how they were perpetrated. We look at the characteristics of the perpetrators themselves, you know, who they are, you know, how old they are, you know, what positions they hold within the organization. And we look at also the, you know, the various industries affected by these major cases across the United States. In the last report, which we just published, we looked at 554 cases we identified that we hadn't seen in prior years, new cases that have popped up in the course of a year. that alone is staggering, just to imagine the number of cases that are happening all around us throughout the United States, let alone in Vermont. So that's something that's always shocked me. But to get back to the analysis, we created something we call the embezzlement propensity factors to allow us to compare different geographic regions, in this case, states. So we took this, and the embezzlement propensity factor, or EPF we called it, is really an average of two ratios. And those two ratios are based on two, we think, very reasonable theories. The first theory is that the amount of fraud in a given state is going to be proportional to the economic activity in that state. And then the second ratio is, the second theory is that the amount of the number of these major cases in a given population should be proportional to that population. So what we did is we took the average of both. In the first instance, the state share of overall losses to the United States divided by the percent state share of the total U.S. GDP, and then we averaged that with the state share of the total number of cases in the United States versus the state share of population in the United States. So,
Chris, what I'm getting here is that it's a complicated formula, and you're really trying to look at the numbers in a fair way to take into account, you know, how much of the GDP Vermont is responsible for, and how much embezzlement there is, and when you put the two together, it looks like Vermont's very high on the list. But do you have a sense of why? What it is about Vermont?
Yes, I think there are a number of factors. I mean, it's a good question. It's a fair question. And what we saw was, as you mentioned, three times in the last 6 years, Vermont came on top. It's been on the list of the top 10, I think, five out of the last 6 years. So clearly something is going on. And when you just look at it empirically, there's a whole lot of embezzlement going on in Vermont, as you read in the papers.
Mm-hmm. A lot of it doesn't even rise to that $100,000 level.
That is correct. There are a lot of cases we didn't even look at simply because they weren't that big. I'm looking at a list of 35 cases of $100,000 or more in the past, since 2008 in Vermont. That's a lot of cases. So, but to answer your question, and I think, it's a difficult one to answer, but there are several factors. Well, going back to the analysis, we found that the types of industries most affected are, number one, financial institutions, banks, et cetera, number two, government entities, and number three, nonprofits and religious organizations. So when we look at Vermont, and the other thing we learned is that small businesses are at great risk, small family-owned businesses in particular that end up relying on a single bookkeeper, for example, to manage their finances. So when we look at Vermont, we see a state that's got, of course, lots and lots of small mom-and-pop shops throughout the state, family-run businesses often relying on a single bookkeeper. The business people, the entrepreneurs, they enjoy doing the business part. They enjoy creating whatever they're creating and the selling part of it and the networking, et cetera. They don't particularly like the back-end bookkeeping. So they hire a bookkeeper. It's a single individual. Maybe it's a part-time bookkeeper, for that matter. Comes in, does the books, and they end up relying on that person. They're there for years and years. And in many cases, they start stealing. And it just goes right under the radar of the business owners, who are not paying attention necessarily because they've come to trust this individual. And it goes on and on for years and years, and it builds up to, large numbers. So that's one factor. The second factor is when you look at the state of Vermont, as you and your listeners probably know, Vermont's got a disproportionately high number of nonprofit organizations. In fact, I think I heard that it was the number one state in the union for nonprofits per capita. So the other thing we found, as I mentioned before, nonprofits, religious organizations at high risk for embezzlement. Again, the same reason. Nonprofits, the people who sit on the boards, the overseers, they're interested in the cause of the nonprofit. They're not necessarily trained in finance. They're not necessarily financial people themselves. And therefore, the oversight factor in a lot of nonprofits just isn't adequate. It's certainly not adequate relative to, you know, many businesses and the standards that businesses employ. So with a high number of nonprofits in the state of Vermont, again, you've got, I think, a higher risk. So the third factor is government entities. Government entities, again, were our number two most frequent victim. And in the state of Vermont, in many other smaller states or states that are dispersed population-wise, you've got lots of small towns, hamlets, that have very small, finance departments, so, you know, single treasurer, sometimes even a part-time treasurer. You looked at the town of Ira, Vermont, that lost, I think it was $440,000, to Don Hewitt. This individual was meeting once a month with the, you know, at his home around the table, you know, joking, month after month and not really providing any of the underlying documents.
Chris, I'm going to have to leave you there, but so interesting. I appreciate your analysis. You know, the things that we value, small communities, small mom and pop businesses, leave us vulnerable for this kind of embezzlement. That's what Chris Marquet has found. His investigative security consulting firm published a recent report naming Vermont as the state most at risk for major embezzlement problems. We have his report at vpr.net. Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane.
And that'll do it for today. Tomorrow, school enrollment numbers continue to decline. Property taxes keep going up. How can the legislature address education funding in Vermont without compromising educational quality and equity? We'll take that up with Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb. Listen for that conversation tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.